Looking at the prophet Isaiah. Now, Isaiah had a lot to say about the coming Messiah. He detailed a lot of his life, the experiences he would go through in his life, his death, the church. He had quite a lot to say, and so that has led some to describe Isaiah as either the messianic prophet or the evangelistic prophet. And some of his prophecies, they were maybe a bit generic. So as Christians, we'd see them, we'd latch onto them for any clue that we might see pertaining to Christ's purpose. But those who don't believe might look at them and say, well, it's kind of generic. It fits Christ, but it could fit a number of people. So as we go through the 53rd chapter this evening, I'd like to be noticing, one, how perfectly it lines up with the life of Christ, especially as we get further into the 53rd chapter. And then we'll also notice, as some of those details start to get more specific, it becomes extremely difficult to try to dismiss this as being generic. Okay, it may fit Jesus, but it could fit other people. Some of these details, the word that comes to mind for me is quirky or odd. And in fact, I thought about titling the sermon this evening Oddly Specific, because there's one verse in particular we'll notice where it's just oddly specific in my view. And so that really pushes us to one of two logical assessments of this passage. We can say, one, God did this. There is a divine, all-knowing God. He revealed the future through his prophet. And that is what we have. That is, you know, the Bible is what it claims to be. And the other logical view that, of course, we would not accept, but some would, is that the text was changed over time. You know, Jesus lived and died a couple thousand years ago. And how do we know that the words we read today really line up with what was written way back then? And so after we've gone through the 53rd chapter, we're going to spend some time noticing just how much confidence we can really have in Isaiah and this chapter also. And what we're going to see, I don't want to spoil the surprise, but I'm sure you all have, since you're here this evening, I don't think you are in doubt of the accuracy of the scriptures, but what we're going to see is that we can have a great deal of confidence that what we read today is in fact what was written very long ago. So let's go ahead and jump into it. Well, I guess actually let's notice from the scripture reading. The thought of Isaiah 53 actually begins with those last few verses of 52. It talks about he will be high and lifted up, greatly exalted. And then it also says he was marred more than any man. We've already started off with kind of an odd mix of points. Typically, if someone is greatly exalted and they're lifted up and they're celebrated and respected, typically they're not also marred more than any man. Now, of course, that fits Jesus because it depends entirely on which audience you're talking about. He was embraced by one group and persecuted and ultimately killed by another group. And so we're already starting off to see some things that, while it's not extremely specific, it's certainly starting to get a little bit specific towards the Lord. Now, let's start in with the 53rd chapter. We'll notice in the first three verses, it talks about his modest circumstances into which he was born. Beginning in verse 1, who has believed our message? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a tender plant, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form, and he had no majesty that we should look at him. He had no attractiveness that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by others, a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering, and like one from whom people hide their faces, we despised him. We did not value him. That dry ground and a tender plant root coming out of dry ground, that speaks of the beginning of a plant. If you're talking about a person and making comparison there, that would be describing his birth, the circumstances into which he was born. And if you imagine a root coming out of dry ground, that's not That's not a well-positioned plant. It's not a rich plant that has a rich environment in which to prosper. It's describing poverty, very humble circumstances. If we look at Luke chapter 2 and verse 7, describing circumstances into which Jesus was born, it says, "And she gave birth to her firstborn son. She wrapped him in cloths and laid him in a manger because there was no room for him at the inn." I think even people who are not Christians are for the most part familiar with the general story of Jesus' birth. And it makes a great story. It works very well in the children's classes. Even from a young age, they learn that story. And as adults, I think it's easy for us to romanticize the circumstances of his birth, how he was laid in a manger. But let's recognize what this was. This was an act of poverty and desperation. If someone was wealthy, if someone had money and power, one way or another, if they are in town, they would not be giving birth among the livestock. Someone with means could have one way or another found some kind of better circumstance to bring a new life into this world. And Jesus was born into poverty. A few verses later, in Luke chapter 2 and verse 24, it describes the sacrifice that they offered after his birth. And it says that they offered a sacrifice according to what was said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. Now you may recall back from Leviticus, there were several sacrifices that were allowable for the Jews to make. Typically it was a male from the flock, either from the sheep or the goats, and it was supposed to be a male without blemish. But provision was made for the poor. They could offer a sacrifice that was birds, either turtle doves or young pigeons. And so we see the idea reinforced that at the time of Jesus' birth, he was born into very humble circumstances. These verses, the first three verses of Isaiah, also start to hint at the idea of persecution and suffering. It says he was despised and rejected, familiar with suffering. We despised him. You'll recall that Jesus' persecution started very early on in his life. In Matthew chapter 2, verses 13 and 14, shortly after his birth, it says, "Now when they had gone up, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, 'Get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him.' So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother while it was still night, and they left for Egypt." What we see is that even from Jesus's early life, there was persecution. They were fleeing, they were suffering, and he was not wealthy and powerful. Let's continue on to verses 6 and 7 of Isaiah 53. It starts to get a lot more specific now. You know, those first few verses could apply to a number of people, and it's going to start to narrow down and get a lot more specific. Verse 4, "Surely he has borne our sufferings and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken, struck down by God and afflicted." Notice that since this is appearing in the book of Isaiah, a Jewish prophet, when he says "we," he would be speaking about his kinsmen, his fellow Jews. You'll recall from Matthew chapter 27 and verse 22, as Jesus was on trial and about to be crucified, Pilate said to them, to the crowd gathered at the time, "Then what shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" They all said, "Crucify him." And he said, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they kept shouting all the more, "Crucify him." You see, it was his own kinsmen, his own countrymen, who considered him stricken, who caused him to be afflicted in this way. Let's continue on. Isaiah 53 and verse 5. "But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that made us whole was upon him, and by his bruises we are healed." Some translations render that he was pierced through for our transgressions. But we're getting very specific now. It's not just that they caused him to suffer. It's not just that they somehow got him crucified. it says that his punishment made us whole, right? It was his suffering that benefited the people that caused it. They didn't just cause it, it benefited them. You'll also recall that when they nailed him to the cross and when they pierced his side, he was pierced. And this is, again, lining up very clearly with the experiences we see, the circumstances we see from Jesus' life and death. Also, in Matthew 20 and verse 28, it says, "Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for many." You see, the purpose Christ came for was so that he could suffer and die and take upon himself the punishment that each of us was due. And we're going to see that continue to be elaborated on in Isaiah. Continuing on to verse 6. "All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned each of us his own way. And the Lord has laid on us the iniquity of us all." So what is it that caused Isaiah to go through this? The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. You see, we did this, we caused this, we collectively, meaning mankind, and he paid for it. I think we could fairly say that God took our debt and piled it on him. At this point, we're very far from some kind of generic reference to someone who suffered. It's not just that Jesus suffered. He suffered to benefit others. He suffered to pay the debt, the punishment that others were due. We're detailing the purpose Christ came for in the book of Isaiah, hundreds of years before Jesus was born. Let's continue on. Verses 7 and 8. 7 through 9. We'll start with just 7. "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, as a sheep that is before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth." Mark and Matthew both record that he refused to defend himself before the high priest. They pressed him and keep pressing him. And eventually he acknowledged who he was. I mean, it's not like Jesus was going to deny who he was or what he came for. But when it was time for him to offer his defense, he refused to comment. Mark chapter 14, beginning in verse 60. "The high priest stood up and came forward and questioned Jesus, saying, 'Do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you?' But he kept silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest was questioning him and saying, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?' Jesus answered, 'I am. You shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven.'" He will eventually acknowledge who he is, but they also record that Herod, when Herod interrogated him, he refused to comment. Continuing on in verse 8 of Isaiah 53, "From detention and judgment he was taken away. And who can even think about his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living. He was stricken for the transgressions of my people." So he died because of the transgressions of others. We've gone from his birth, that tender plant coming out of dry ground, to his death. Now he's cut off from the land of the living. All of this coming from that messianic prophet long before Jesus was born. Verse 9. "They made his grave with the wicked, and with rich people in his tomb, although he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth." Some translations render that his grave was assigned with wicked men, yet he was with a rich man in his death. Now, I think we, most of us, know exactly what that's talking about. He was crucified among two thieves, one on his right, one on his left. When the Romans get done executing someone, they don't give them a glorious funeral and a glorious burial. Typically hauled out and their body is discarded, city dump, or someplace. It is not a burial of honor. And if you look at the circumstances of his death, that is what he was due. That is what he was on track for. Crucified between two thieves, anyone would have told you, where's his body going to be in a few hours? Well, with those other two guys laying in the dump. And yet in Matthew chapter 27 and verse 57, it says that when it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus, and Pilate ordered it be given to him. So Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out in the rock, and he rolled a large stone against the entrance of the tomb and went away. So clearly, assigned with wicked men in his death, and yet among the rich. That, as I look at that verse, I just think oddly specific. You know, many of the things we've noticed so far and continuing through the rest of the chapter, it's explaining the timeline, it's explaining his purpose. We see prophecies explaining Jesus as a person, some of his attributes, what he came to accomplish. What does this remark really add? It's not telling you about his purpose. It's a little bit quirky. It's spot on accurate. It is exactly like what we see in the New Testament. As Christians, we would look at that and say, well, of course, this is the Word of God. This is God's revelation. And God is throwing in some obscure details. It looks like a riddle in Isaiah's time. They would have read that and just wondered, what is this talking about? Assigned with the wicked, yet with the rich. But then you come along and observe what actually happened as Jesus was crucified, and it all makes perfect sense. So as Christians, we look and we celebrate these ideas, or these details, and we're very impressed at the power and knowledge of God. But things like this really eliminate any kind of middle ground for someone who doesn't have that true respect for the Bible. They're going to look at this and have a hard time explaining this kind of detail, with one possible exception. They can say, someone changed it, right? A couple thousand years. How can you really trust that's what it said before Jesus was born? And so they will accuse it of being altered over time, with many passages of Scripture, but this one, of course, is a great candidate for that. And hang in there. We'll get there soon. Let's continue on, finishing out the last bit of the chapter. Verse 10, yet the Lord was willing to crush him. He made him suffer. Although you make his soul an offering for sin, he will see his offspring, and he will prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will triumph in his hand. In verse 8, he was killed for others. In verse 9, he's put in the grave. In verse 10, he will see his offspring and prolong his days. He's alive again, right? Killed in verse 8, buried in verse 9, alive again in verse 10, seeing his offspring. Let's continue on. Verse 11, out of the suffering of his soul, he will see light and find satisfaction. Through his knowledge, his servant, the righteous one, will make many righteous. He will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will allot him a portion with the great. He will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life to death, was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bore the sins of many and made intercession for their transgressions. As Isaiah records it, it is very clear that Jesus came for the purpose of offering himself to be a sacrifice. He came for the purpose of dying. The tone also implies choice. It is because he did this that he is being elevated and rewarded. So that implies he could have avoided it. And again, why would someone do that? Why would Isaiah write such a thing? Someone who is an atheist is going to have a very hard time accepting that Isaiah really wrote this so long ago. And the passages like this, where it gets into such detail, it really pushes us, I think, to one of those two logical assessments. So now, let's take a brief break from our study of Isaiah. I'd like to tell you a story about a young man named Mohammed Ezdib. I probably butchered the pronunciation, but that's what we're going to go with this evening. He was a young man in 1946 or 47, and his chores, his task was to watch over the livestock. He was a shepherd. And as the story goes, he was out looking for a stray goat one day, and he lived in the area that's called Qumran. It's east of Israel, on the north shore of the Dead Sea, or near the Dead Sea, in that vicinity. And it's a very dry area. It's a desert land. There's a lot of rock, a little bit of vegetation, so the goats can find something to eat. But he was looking for a lost goat. And he was bored. And being a young man, unsupervised, bored, with a lot of rocks around, he starts doing what most young boys would do at that age. He started throwing rocks. And he saw a hole in the side of a hill, and he starts throwing rocks at that hole. And eventually he gets a rock to go through the hole. And he heard something break. Being a curious young man, he then wiggled into the hole and looked in there. As many of you, I suspect, have guessed, this is the story of what we today call the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is how they were discovered. So in the 1940s, a young boy looking for a goat throwing rocks, and he heard a noise when he threw a rock through a hole. Altogether, he found 10 ceramic jars in that cave and 7 scrolls. And initially, they had difficulty. The family thought, they're going to sell them. They had some difficulty selling them because the people they could find and approach, they thought, well, they're fake, or they're stolen, or something suspicious about this. And so they had a little bit of difficulty selling them. But eventually they got them sold. And as the authorities heard of it and came and investigated, they did quite a bit more searching. And over the next decade, the local Bedouins and also some scientific researchers, they went on to discover more than 900 manuscripts in 11 caves. They're all in this area around Qumran. That is cave number 4, right there. So some of them are harder to get to, some are easier to get to. There's quite a diversity in what's contained in those caves. I found some suggestions that they're probably not all coordinated or affiliated with one another. There may have been multiple things deposited. They date from the last 3 centuries BC through the 1st century AD. And the scrolls include copies of Genesis, Exodus, Isaiah, Kings, Deuteronomy, other canonical works from the Hebrew Bible. There's also calendars and hymns and psalms and non-Bible documents. There's even a scroll made out of copper that describes the location of a treasure. So there's quite a variety of things in there. Altogether, there's approximately 100,000 fragments. Some of the documents were broken, and they're very fragile, and so they broke into a large number of pieces. But there's many thousands of fragments. There are a few manuscripts that are nearly intact and very well preserved. Most of it's Hebrew. There's some in Aramaic, and there's a few documents in Greek. Approximately 40% are copies of the Hebrew scriptures. There's another 30% that are from what they call the Second Temple period. They were not canonized in the Hebrew Bible, but it's other documents from that time frame. Some of them you may have heard of. It's things like the Book of Enoch, the Book of Jubilee, the Book of Tobit, that old Hebrew documents. Then there's also a number of sectarian manuscripts that shed a lot of light on the rules and beliefs of the people of the day and some of their civil procedures. But what's of particular interest to us this evening is what they've called the Great Isaiah Scroll. It is the entire book of Isaiah. It's written in the Essene dialect of Hebrew. You'll notice that it's in several pieces, but that is everything from the beginning of Isaiah through the end of it. And you'll notice there's some areas where there's a little bit of physical damage on the sides. There are a few words that are missing, but it is essentially intact. And this has been dated to 100 BC, which becomes very interesting for us considering that Isaiah is referred to as the messianic prophet. He had so much to say about Christ. And here's a document that was written approximately 100 years before Jesus was born, long before anyone would have had opportunity to go back and change the text to line up with his life after the fact. You may remember the Essenes. We studied them roughly a year ago in the adult class. We were looking at that period between the Testaments after the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. Some of those lessons dealt with the factions within the Jews at that time frame, and the Essenes were one of those groups. They had reacted to the Hellenistic or Greek influence of the day, and there was a group called the Hasidim, and it was called the Party of the Pious. That's where the Pharisees come from, and it's thought that that is also where the Essenes come from. Some scholars have also suggested that perhaps the Essenes are the Jews who returned from Babylon just prior to the time of the Maccabean high priest Jonathan, roughly 152 to 143 BC. But the Essenes are regarded as being very close to the Pharisees. They had a lot of doctrinal similarity. They abstained from marriage. They lived in seclusion. They secluded themselves in communities. They had all things in common. They were restrained and sober. They rejected all oaths. Like the Pharisees, they believed in the immortality of the soul, in either a place of comfort or torment. They're not mentioned in the gospel because they were rather reclusive, and for the most part, they were withdrawn from society at that time. The scholars estimate there were roughly 4,000 of them. What's also interesting to us is that there's just a few variations between that manuscript and the second oldest copy of Isaiah, which is roughly 1,000 years newer. The Essenes were not the group who was revered by the rabbis as being those who would preserve and protect the scriptures. They were not the ones who were tasked with making meticulous, perfect copies of it. They spoke their own dialect, and so they made some very minor adjustments into their own dialect. This would have been presumably a working copy of the scripture for them in the dialect that they spoke. And so when we consider that, it makes it very remarkable how nearly identical it still is to the other copies that are so much newer. You might think of it kind of like, you know, throughout English history, there have been transitions from saying ye and thee and thou to just saying you, or thine versus yours. Or if you want a more timely reference, what are we supposed to call the carbonated beverages, right? Is that pop or is it soda? And if someone asks for a Coke, are you supposed to ask what kind, right? There's variation within language. And so they had made some very minor variations in personal pronouns, word spelling, that type of thing. But aside from that, it is essentially the same as the other copies that we have that are so much newer. But what is especially interesting is that that copy predates Jesus' birth by somewhere around 100 years. So now the obvious question is, well, how close is that to our book of Isaiah? How closely would that read? I need to admit something to you. When someone stands before you and preaches, you generally assume that they're reading from a standard, respected translation of the Bible, right? American Standard, New American Standard, Old King James, New King James, something mainstream, heavily scrutinized, and respected. And this evening, when I've read from Isaiah, I was not actually reading from my Bible. I was reading from something published by the Israel Museum at Jerusalem. They have a translation of the great Isaiah scroll that they have published. And I was reading that translation as we went through Isaiah chapter 53. You may have noticed a few of the words are a little different. What really jumped out to me is in verse 8, it said his detention. I searched online in the translations. I checked, the word detention does not appear. That's not a word that just feels to me like a word that appears in the Bible. Other translations render that his oppression or something like that. It's the same idea, right? It's a synonym. But the point is, they translated it into modern day English. Their translation flows well, it's polished English, but it matches very well with what we read in our Bibles. And some of you are probably, I'm sure, familiar with this, but there is a bit of discretion and judgment that translators must exercise, because words don't always appear in the same order in one language and another. Sometimes, does the adjective come before or after the noun? Like our Bibles in Isaiah 53, when it says dry ground, well, in Hebrew, that's going to be ground dry. And that just seems wrong to us. It's a different language. We don't realize sometimes how much our thinking and our perception of proper thought is really controlled by our native language. And so translators have to exercise a bit of judgment in making their translations. And the translation published by the museum is well polished, flows well in English. So I'd also like to read to you another translation that I found. It's by a scholar who's very reluctant to exercise judgment or discretion. He does a little bit of reordering, but it's when he thinks he has to, so it makes sense to you in English. He leaves things a lot more choppy. It's much closer to a literal word-for-word translation that in places sounds awkward in English. But this will make clear to us, you know, just how well aligned what we read in our Bibles really is with that original text. Because as I listen to this, if you follow along, just ask yourself, okay, if we make it proper English, something my English teacher would have approved of, would it not match what I read in my Bible? So one more time, Isaiah 53, beginning in verse 1. And he chooses not to translate the Hebrew word for Lord. He leaves that as Yahweh, which is one of their names for God. Hebrew 53, beginning in verse 1. Who has believed our report, and the arm of Yahweh, to whom has it been revealed? And he shall come up like a suckling before us, and as a root from dry ground, there is no form to him, and no beauty to him, and in his being seen, and there is no appearance that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and knowing grief, and as though hiding faces from him, he was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely our griefs he is bearing, and our sorrows he carried them, and we esteemed him beaten, and struck by God, and afflicted. And he is wounded for our transgressions, and crushed for our iniquities, and the correction of our peace was upon him, and by his wounds he has healed us. All of us like sheep have wandered, each man to his own way, and we have turned, and Yahweh has caused to light on him the iniquity of all of us. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, and he did not open his mouth, and as a lamb to the slaughter he is brought, and as a ewe before her shearers he is made dumb and did not open his mouth. From prison and from judgment he was taken, and his generation, who shall discuss it? Because he was cut off from the land of the living. Because from the transgression of his people, a wound was to him. and they gave wicked ones to be his grave, and rich ones in his death, although he worked no violence, neither deceit in his mouth. And Yahweh was pleased to crush him, and he has caused him grief. If you will appoint his soul a sin offering, he will see his seed, and he will lengthen his days, and the pleasure of Yahweh in his hand will advance. Of the toil of his soul he shall see it, and light, and he shall be satisfied, and by his knowledge shall he make righteous, even my righteous servant, for many, and their iniquities he will bear. Therefore I will apportion to him among the great ones, and with the mighty ones he shall divide the spoil, because he laid bare to death his soul, and with the transgressors he was numbered. And he, the sins of many, he bore, and for their transgressions he entreated. So parts of that, some expressions talking about, you know, when hidden his face from him, obviously some of the expressions have a little bit of challenge being translated from Hebrew into Greek, but other than it being choppy, awkward English, there's no real difference between that and what you've read in your own Bible. And so if we imagine that, a translator just exercising the normal, minimal amount of discretion to make it proper English, it would match straight up with any one of our typical translations. Just really interesting that of all the things we could have preserved from that far back, I can't help but wonder about the providence of God. Why is it that we have the Messianic prophet preserved from 100 BC? His words, his predictions of the Christ, all the details of what he would accomplish in his church, were already written on paper 100 years before he was born. And as I understand it, you know, the areas that have the physical damage, obviously there's words missing, but they look at it and they say the words that are the empty space from the missing fragments is the right amount of space for the words that are missing that we would anticipate to be there. And so essentially, the manuscript is exactly what you'd expect if you had an outstanding copy, exactly like what we have, with a few variations for dialect, and then a few pieces broken off and gone. It is an incredible evidence to us that the Bible is trustworthy and reliable. As we finish up this evening, I've not spoken about what it takes to be a Christian, but I think we've spent the entire evening discussing how much confidence we ought to have in being Christians, and how much confidence we ought to have in the Lord's Word, the accuracy and trustworthiness of it. So if any this evening have not confessed their belief in the Lord, we would encourage you to do so. We would encourage you to be baptized and become a Christian. This is not a faith that is based on ignorance. It's not a faith that's based on lack of questioning or scrutiny. It is a faith that can be based on confidence and understanding. And we would encourage any and all to become a part of it. If any is subject to the invitation and needs to become a Christian, we would encourage you to come forward and do so. Well, together we stand and sing the invitation song.